Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is focusing today on how officials in the state of Mississippi responded in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Emails released on Monday by the House Government Reform Committee show that federal emergency management officials in Mississippi urgently warned of not having enough food, water, and ice, that the system was broken, and that there might be riots. In day two of committee hearings this morning, Republican Christopher Shays of Connecticut peppered the man who sent some of those emails, FEMA former top responder in Mississippi, William Carwile, about when then-FEMA Director Michael Brown first reached him after the storm.
What was the first contact and defined contact?
He came over to visit Mississippi with Robert, myself, and the governor.
When was that?
That was about day three after landfall, sir.
So we're talking Wednesday or Thursday?
Yes, sir.
So no contact on Friday before, no contact on Saturday before, no contact on Sunday before, no contact on Monday, no contact on Tuesday with the head of FEMA?
That's correct.
And you are the person in charge of FEMA in Mississippi, correct?
That's correct, sir.
That's amazing. To me, it is amazing.
Also, Mississippi's Republican Governor Haley Barbour was not alone in calling for more action and money now from Congress. Joining us on the line from Washington is reporter Anna Radulet. She writes for the Gannett News Service. And Anna, this is the second day of hearing. So first of all, what jumped out at you?
A couple of things. The Mississippians are here, of course, one of the main goals that most of the Mississippi government came to testify is that they want more money fast, more than the $60 billion that has been approved by Congress and the President to help hurricane aid. They need another emergency spending packet, and they need it before the end of the year. And what they need in the package is what the President and Congress hasn't given them. The President wants the next package to be $17 billion of money reallocated for FEMA to fix things that the government has to fix. Highways, bases, army, military bases, schools, stuff that the government under the law has to repair. What the Mississippians want is another $18.4 billion, most of that money to be spent to help uninsured flood victims. About half of the homes that were destroyed or damaged are thought to be people who lack flood insurance and are going to have a tough time rebuilding or repaying their mortgages or rebuilding their homes.
Well, in fact, Governor Barbour said tons of debris still remains on the ground. Even though 24,000 temporary homes were built at a record pace, 10,000 more are needed, and that school districts in Mississippi are approaching bankruptcy. Now, we understand there may have been a package of tax breaks passed.
No, they're also waiting for packages. That's the second thing that they're lobbying for here. They're waiting, they're pushing for a package of tax breaks to businesses in Katrina-hit areas that the Republicans believe would spur, rebuilding. But that's going to be a fight because some House leaders want to exclude casinos from that package.
Right. In fact, we should say, Anna Radulet, you are at the hearing, but we are reading that the AP is just reporting that the House has passed some of these tax breaks. But yes, the concern is who's going to get them? Will they be used by, hot tub facilities or by homeowners and other businesses? But I know you were saying that something else jumped out at you from the hearings besides this money that's being asked for. So please let us know that.
Yes, there was a call for one of the Democrats on the committee for information from the White House. He said he was frustrated, and this committee is largely Republicans because the Democrats have boycotted this committee. They said they did not like how this committee was set up. But one of the Democrats on the committee who's been, there have been a couple of Gulf Coast Democrats who have been sitting in on these hearings. One of them, Charlie Melanson from Louisiana, today said he wanted to try to subpoena the White House for documents relating to the White House's preparations for the storm and its response after the storm. And so we've got kind of, I think Melanson is acting in part because the government of Louisiana had to cough up a lot of documents showing how they were, you know, their communications and what they were doing before and after the storm.
Well, Anna Radulet, in the few seconds we have, these emails that were released on Monday were explosive. These were from the top FEMA administrator in the state, William Carwile. In just the few seconds we have, I mean, it sounds as if legislators are reacting to those. Anna?
Yes.
Oh, there you are. We just have a few seconds now, but it sounds as if legislators are reacting to some of these explosive emails that were released.
It was unknown because all the attention or much of the attention had been on the problems in Louisiana, and Mississippi was kind of, you know, how Mississippi survived or how it was hit right after the, you know, by the storm was kind of secondary. But here for the first time, those emails show that there was concern about a lack of control, that there might be rioting in Mississippi because people were suffering from some of the same things that the Louisiana from, lack of food, lack of water.
But no one was hearing about that. Anna Radulet, a reporter with the Gannett Service, she's covering the House Government Reform Committee hearings in Washington, and we appreciate your time, Anna. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
In a speech to the Council on Foreign Relations today, President Bush said the American effort to impose democracy in Iraq has several advantages.
By helping Iraqis continue to build their democracy, we will gain an ally in the war on terror. By helping them build a democracy, we will inspire reformers from Damascus to Tehran. And by helping them build a democracy, we'll make the American people more secure.
With Iraqis preparing to go to the polls again in less than 2 weeks, the Arab world is watching. Whether it's Egypt, which just completed its own parliamentary elections, or other countries such as Syria and Lebanon, regimes and reformers alike are waiting for the results and bracing for the aftershocks. Well, we mentioned that President Bush spoke to the Council on Foreign Relations today. We have some people familiar with that group with us now. We're joined by two experts, Craig Charney, who is a consultant to the Council on Foreign Relations and the president of Charney Research, a company that studies public opinion in the Arab world, including holding some fascinating focus groups. We'll hear about those. And Stephen Cook is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an expert on U.S. Middle East policy. And Stephen, I want to start with you first, because you've written, many Arabs look at the Iraqi elections and the ink-stained purple fingers we saw, and they want the same thing, but they don't want democracy imposed at the end of a tank. But can't President Bush say his push for democracy has had an effect in the region? We've seen the pullout from Gaza, the withdrawal of Syrian troops from Lebanon, or just take the recent push for elections in Egypt.
I certainly think that the overall context of politics in the region changed as a result of two things. First, the Bush administration's clear, forthright call for democracy and freedom in the region, and then the Iraqi elections. I wouldn't go so far as to suggest that there's a causal relationship between what happened in Iraq last January 30th and the political agitation in Egypt. There has been reformers and demands for change in Egypt for a long time, but there's no denying the fact that as the United States has sought to stir things up in the region and drive events in the region, and the events in Iraq have had an effect on the thinking of people not only in Egypt but in Lebanon, in Morocco, in even Syria, which remains closed, Jordan and Saudi Arabia.
Well, turning to Craig Charney, you did focus groups in the region, and they are fascinating to read some of the accounts on them. I want to talk more about them, but you said that in some of these focus groups, Iraq was a conversation stopper. I mean, people would just get so upset about the topic.
It's true. Iraq is a real problem from the viewpoint of many people in the Arab and Muslim worlds. It helps to contribute to an image of the U.S. as domineering, as forceful, as trying to impose its will. At the same time, this is partly the case also because American public diplomacy efforts to tell about other things the Americans have been doing in the Muslim world have been so weak.
Let's talk more about that, because recently we hear stories about the U.S. military paying Iraqi reporters to plant positive stories in the Iraqi media. Why can't they get that right? I mean, what seems to be the problem there?
Well, paying people to plant stories in the Iraqi media is certainly not what we had in mind by public diplomacy. The kinds of things that were recommended as a result of our research were finding better ways to tell America's story about its involvement in development efforts openly, finding local spokespeople or beneficiaries. These are the ways to tell America's story in a way that will be convincing, compelling, and credible.
Again, it's so fascinating. You quote from Muslims, Arabs that you met in the different focus groups, who remember as children seeing packages that had the U.S. emblem on them, U.S. aid, and they had no idea how much aid was going to their countries today.
Exactly. American assistance has become invisible to its beneficiaries. Even in Egypt, which is the largest single recipient of U.S. development assistance, people had no idea how much their country was receiving. And they'd never heard of any of a list of major projects, like moving the largest pollution source in the country, a huge lead smelter, out of the city that the U.S. had sponsored.
Tell us some of the things that they told you when you told them how much aid in dollars was coming to their countries.
Well, some of them said, how can that be? Where did all the money go? Others, when we told them about, say, the health clinics in Egypt that had saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of kids, said, wasn't that Mrs. Mubarak, the president's wife? Or when we mentioned the low-polluting buses that have helped to leave the air of Cairo a little less foul, they said, that was the Japanese, wasn't it?
One fellow said to you, that can't be, because if that's really true, that the U.S. is helping us that much, we'd be friends.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what we learned was that if they found out more about what America was doing in their own countries, which are what matters to them most, that would make a great deal of difference in addition to all the news they're receiving about what's going on in Iraq and other places.
If I can just pick up on something that
sure.
Craig had said, there is so much that the United States has been doing in a place like Egypt that's positive that Egyptians have absolutely no idea about.
Such as,
for example, an example I use all the time. The U.S. Agency for International Development was a primary agency in helping the Egyptians restore large sections of Islamic Cairo. This is Egypt's Islamic patrimony, a legacy to the world. Beautiful place. There's no indication other than a small sign that says a gift to the American people through the agency, the U.S. Agency for International Development. But this is a part of Cairo where nobody speaks English. They won't understand that. We don't get our message across. Everybody in Cairo knows that the Japanese built the Opera House, but nobody knows what the United States has done.
Now, is this the fault of the U.S. or of the Egyptians?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. First, yeah. The United States has been reluctant to brand everything. I think to our detriment.
It's a tricky line.
Exactly. And then at the same time, we entered into an agreement with the Egyptians in which our development projects in Egypt were subject to the approval of the Egyptian government. And so that created a very tricky political situation for the United States and what they could and could not do and what they could and could not advertise what they were doing.
Hmm. Craig, I know you wanted to jump in with something.
Yes. I simply wanted to follow up on one of Stephen's points. It's quite clear that one of the things that hurts us the most is the sense that we're betraying our own principles. It's precisely America's support for its principles that are seen as one of its strengths in the eyes of Muslims. They talked about how much they admire the rule of law in our country. They contrasted our jails favorably to Egyptian jails. This was what gave the prison abuses of Abu Ghraib its sting, precisely the idea that we were not living up to its ideals. In fact, it's not so much that people hate us. They feel disappointed in us.
I have to interrupt. The Egyptian woman who said to you, America is like this great guy. What did she say?
He's like this great guy who every once in a while does something stupid, and then you start to hate him.
That's Craig Charney. We also spoke with Stephen Cook. They're American experts on the Arab world. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, they'll tell us what can the U.S. do to turn around public opinion in the Arab world and why that's important. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation on Arab reaction to developments in Iraq and actually in the entire Middle East. We're talking with Craig Charney of the Council on Foreign Relations and the president of Charney Research, and Stephen Cook, fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an expert on U.S. Mideast policy. And Steve, how do Arabs view the debate in this country over possibly withdrawing from Iraq?
What is now most important in the eyes of Arabs is how Iraq turns out. We've gone in, we've broken this country. It's now our responsibility to put it back together. And the Arabs are looking for the United States to do it. In addition to the fact there's sort of this cognitive dissonance. Here is this great superpower. We stride the world. Nobody can match us. Yet we can't get the electricity on. Mm. We can't get the water flowing reliably. They don't seem to really understand this, because it's become commonsensical in the minds of many Arabs, is that, of course, the United States can do absolutely anything. It's a superpower. So the withdrawal of U.S. troops will help us in Iraq only if there's significant progress both on the political front and the security front.
And just, Craig, how does that impact other shaky situations? For instance, you were just in Lebanon, and I'm wondering if people there, the Lebanese, might be looking over at Iraq and wondering how much should we get behind any efforts to change regime in Syria?
I think there are two things we could say about that. One is that if you are in that part of the world and you see the U.S. complaining about persistent violations of UN resolutions by Syria and having a large army on its border, that would look perhaps disturbingly like the run-up to the war in Iraq to you, whether or not U.S. troops are at all likely to cross the border, which I don't think they are. The other is, of course, from the Lebanese viewpoint, that they are very, very glad to be rid of 30 years of Syrian occupation.
Do they credit the U.S. for any of that?
Some of them do. Some of them don't. There are mixed views on that. But what is clear is that they have no particular stomach for further confrontation with the Syrians who've just left.
Hmm. Overall, it's fascinating to us that you both get to spend so much time speaking with people that Americans rarely get to speak with. And any last thoughts about what Arabs have said to you about Americans?
I think the thing for me that's most poignant is there's a sense that there's a gap and a growing gap between the principles that ostensibly guide the United States and its conduct in the world and what we actually do in the world. A famous political scientist named John Waterbury wrote in an article, I guess a year or two ago, love your institutions, hate your policy. And they really do have a tremendous respect for the United States, and that comes through. But they look around at the world right now, and they quite frankly can't make of what the United States is up to. Mm. And to me, that is we have an opportunity, or we've squandered opportunities, but we still have an opportunity to win those people back. We just have to be smart about it. And up to this point, we haven't been very, very smart.
What I've been struck by listening to them over the last year has been not the differences, but the similarities to Americans. When we asked, what's the most important problem facing your country, they practically screamed from their chairs, it's the economy, stupid. Mm-hmm. After that, the priorities, education, health care, the rule of law, the strengthening democracy, improving public safety and improving public services and improving public morality. And how do they want to do that? A phrase that will sound familiar to Americans, rebuilding moral values. These are people who are much more like us than many Americans realize. And if we understand that, we can perhaps find better ways to speak to them.
But I just have to have asked, it doesn't sound as if you came across the Arab Muslims that the U.S. is combating in Iraq. Did you speak to fundamentalists? Who did you speak to? I mean, are they a smaller... Well, go ahead, Steve.
Well, I'm just smiling when you say that, because when you speak to, for example, members of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, these are, you know, alternatively, they're described as extremists, fundamentalists, none of which is true. One of the leading members...
But in fact, we should say they're a political group which officially banned but won a significant number of seats in the recent elections.
That's true. And they're more than just a political group. They're a social movement. And I have heard them say, I have read their statements, I've spoken with members of the Brotherhood who say, what's wrong? We could be the best friends of the United States in the Middle East. They're shrewd. They see the kind of things that Craig is talking about, moral values and the increasing or ostensibly increasing religiosity of Americans and religion in public life in this country. And they say, we have a lot in common. Now, they're saying that you have to take what they say with a grain of salt. But it's interesting when you speak to these people that there is a certain familiarity in discourse.
When we spoke with people and they talked about the importance of Islam in social and political life, and they did, they also emphasized that they thought it ought to be moderate Islam. We didn't come across people who thought Iran was a model. They thought it was an anti-model because they associate it with things like extremism, violence, terror. many of them were fans of Osama bin Laden, but that was because they saw him not as a symbol of Islam, but as a symbol of anti-Americanism, and they were angry at America. Indeed, the tragedy of what we saw in the groups is that the people in our groups who were, by and large, moderate university-educated people, the people who ought to be the natural friends of America, are precisely the people whose sympathy we've been losing.
Well, and that also speaks to a lot, because when you say that you spoke to moderate university-educated people, they probably don't reflect the people who are making up the insurgency in Iraq or enlisting in Al-Qaeda.
That's true. Yeah. But I, something that Craig and I have talked about at length, I don't believe our problem in the Arab world, our meaning the United States' problem in the Arab world, is the street, the so-called Arab street. I think our problem is mainly with the elite, with the university-educated people, the people who we have lost. For all of our diplomatic, political, and military contact between the United States and the Arab world, people know very, very little. It's the opinion leaders, the columnists, what people hear on the radio and watch on television is really forming this kind of widespread anti-American sentiment in the region.
And where you say the U.S. has an opportunity. Stephen Cook, fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an expert on U.S. Middle East policy. Craig Charney, a consultant to the Council and also president of his own company, Charney Research. They study public opinion in the Arab world. It's fascinating. One last question. All these great conversations you're having. Who do you speak the language? Languages?
I do.
You do?
I do.
Don't you? How important is that?
It's very important in kind of breaking down barriers. I think there's a sense that there are people in Washington, people in the United States, who have very strong views about the Middle East but don't understand its history, its politics, and its culture.
Well, Steve, thanks so much, and thank you as well, Craig, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this note, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, public school for three-year-olds, it's a reality already for many, and we'll look at the movement to close the achievement gap by getting those littlest rugrats into school. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After Monday's suicide bombing at a mall in Netanya, Israel, virtually all Palestinians were banned from entering the country, and officials promised to strike back at militants in the West Bank. Bethlehem is in the West Bank, the place where Christians say Jesus was born in a manger because there was no room at the inn. And these days, the city of Bethlehem, on the outskirts of Jerusalem, is emptying out. That's because after 5 years of Palestinian and Israeli clashes, Christian residents are leaving this city of 160,000 in droves, and tourism has fallen dramatically. So, this year, city leaders are taking steps to address the situation by launching what they're calling the Open Bethlehem Project. Before Monday's bombing, we spoke with Bethlehem native and chief executive Leila Sansoura, a Palestinian Christian. We also spoke with the Consul General of Israel in New England. He follows. But I began by asking Ms. Sansoura, what exactly is the Open Bethlehem Project?
Well, it's actually a new city campaign which aims to save Bethlehem for the world. Because, it's a privilege to come from Bethlehem for me. But although it lives in the hearts of millions of people around the world and everybody sings about it, very few people know the plight of Bethlehem today.
Well, we understand by reading a recent Guardian article that because of checkpoints, the wall that Israel has been constructing, and the fighting, it's practically deserted in Bethlehem.
It's not completely deserted. What's happening to Bethlehem today is that the whole city is, if you wish, imprisoned in a very, very tight urban area that has no way of expanding.
So you are issuing passports to try to encourage people to come back. What is that about?
We are trying to say to people that Bethlehem is a word city, and we won't wish the world to treat it as a word city. We're saying that anybody who brings their energy to Bethlehem, everybody who can come, start a word festival, start a conference, bring investment to Bethlehem, will be awarded by an honorary citizenship.
How much do you have to work with these Israeli officials to make this happen realistically? Because it's hard for many people to pass back and forth from Jerusalem proper to Bethlehem.
Yes. We would like to work with the Israeli authorities, obviously, but the problem is that working with Israeli authorities is a very one-sided, discourse, because they just dictate things to us, and in many ways we find ourselves a little bit under their mercy.
But this is supposed to be a new time in Israel, with the withdrawal from Gaza and Ariel Sharon starting a new centrist party.
Well, I mean, one of the things that probably people don't know about is that although Israel is withdrawing currently from Gaza, at the same time, it is not looking so positive for the West Bank, where Bethlehem is, because at the moment what we're witnessing there is that more and more settlement expansions around Bethlehem, which are destined for Jews only, unfortunately, it's taken from lands owned by Bethlehemites, and the wall, obviously, with only two gates to the outside world. I mean, we in Bethlehem today cannot even visit Jerusalem, which is the same diocese as us.
Well, we're going to speak to an Israeli official in a moment, but what do you do about people's perception that Bethlehem is not safe? We remember the violent siege 3 years ago at the Church of Nativity, where Palestinian militants were holed up after Israel invaded parts of the West Bank. How do you telegraph that it's safe to come to Bethlehem?
If you look into all the history, even recent history, there has been no visitor harmed in Bethlehem. And I understand that the wall is a little bit grim and people have to cross a checkpoint to get into our city. But the reality that inside the city there is a real warm welcome to everyone.
Leila, do you worry as, again, I'm reading an account in The Guardian, it seems as if Bethlehem is in jeopardy. Do you worry that Bethlehem as we once knew it could really not exist anymore?
Yes, well, I mean, this is really our biggest fear at the moment. We are really in a state of emergency, and that's why we have launched the Open Bethlehem campaign. We are trying to say to the world that a 4,000-year-old city and with 2,000-year Christian tradition is currently seriously in danger. Bethlehem, as we know it today, might not survive with us for long, and we are really, really asking the world to engage with us, to bring positive energy, and to try and do something about it.
Leila Sansour, Chief Executive of Bethlehem, speaking to us from Bethlehem. Leila, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And for a response, we turn now to Meir Shlomo, the Consul General of Israel to New England. Mr. Consul General, we just heard Ms. Sansour say Bethlehem is in a state of emergency, may not exist in the way that we knew it for long. Do you agree?
I don't think that that is the case. I think this is sort of an overboard description, but you know, the main issue with Bethlehem, first of all, I would like to say that I would like to join the lady who spoke on behalf of Bethlehem and say that we also would encourage everybody to come and visit Bethlehem. It's indeed a very important place with a lot of historical value. And I indeed will offer that the Israeli authorities will ensure the freedom of movement of anybody who wishes to visit Bethlehem. I think it's a great idea.
But as you know, Ms. Sansour said it's difficult to do that, and part of the distress in Bethlehem is being caused by the fact that settlements are surrounding the city. The wall that's been built cuts through different parts of it. There's, according to her, a lack of discourse with Israeli officials. And, you know, independently, London's Guardian newspaper also painted a picture of a city in real distress.
Well, I would contest that with respectfully, because let's look at the facts rather than arguments. First of all, the wall or the security fence or whatever you want to call it started in 2002. This situation has been, unfortunately, already from the year 2000 when people stopped coming to Bethlehem. And the reason is very obvious. The reason is that once the Palestinian started to mount the campaign of terrorism against Israel, we were forced to take some measures into action in order to prevent terrorists from crossing into Israel.
Well, we did mention to her that there is a fear of Palestinian suicide bombers, that, you know, many people are staying away for that reason. But last week, a confidential European Union report was leaked. It accuses Israel of applying measures such as settlement construction, building the wall, destroying Palestinian homes, to strangle East Jerusalem, to prevent the city from becoming the capital of a future Palestinian state. The report says the result of this strategy will be to cut off satellite cities such as Bethlehem and Ramallah and the rest of the West Bank. Your reply?
With all due respect to the European Union, the Israeli position was, is, and will be that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and there's nothing to contest over there. What we would like to see is the Palestinians living in their own state, side by side of the state of Israel and not instead of the state of Israel. There's no revelation in this European Union report. It's only a political interpretation of what one may want or not want to see as a reality on the ground.
Mr. Consul General, have you been to Bethlehem lately, and do you plan on going?
I have not been to Bethlehem lately. I would love to go to Bethlehem when I go to Israel, and I can assure you that anybody that would travel to Bethlehem, as far as the Israeli authorities are concerned, will have a safe passage. By the way, we just opened 2 weeks ago a totally new terminal that is not even remotely looks like a checkpoint. It's a terminal that like between Canada and the United States. And I would say that the campaign of Open Bethlehem should be hand in hand in the campaign of Stop Terrorism.
Meir Shlomo, the Consul General of Israel to New England, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Representatives of most of the countries in the world are wrapping up talks on global warming in Montreal this week. Although the focus is on the Kyoto Protocol, which requires countries to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 2012, the U.S. failure to ratify the protocol is the predominant theme of the conference. Joining us to talk about this is Peter Spatz. He's in Montreal covering the story for the Christian Science Monitor. And Peter, this is the first conference of all the Kyoto participants since the protocol took effect this year. Without the U.S. signing on, of course, this must be difficult.
Well, it certainly is difficult. The U.S. is the single largest industrial emitter of carbon dioxide. So people are very eager to get the United States on board in some fashion. One of the sort of intriguing things about this set of negotiations is that it's actually moving on two tracks. The United States has ratified the 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change, and it's under those talks that folks are hoping to try and engage the United States a little more rigorously. We are not a party to the Kyoto Protocol, as you pointed out, so the United States is not involved directly in those negotiations at all.
Well, but the U.S. position is that voluntary emission reductions are working. A U.S. representative in Montreal, as you well know, points to statistics showing that between 2000 and 2003, emissions went down.
Well, that's true. Part of that, however, is that we were in an economic slump at that time, and we had just gone through 9/11 as well. So a lot of those emissions reductions, a lot of people say, were just really sort of part of the slump of the business cycle and really didn't have anything to do with conscious policies.
Well, we know that today is a key day in the 10 days of talks with substantive steps expected from the delegates there. So what's supposed to happen today?
Well, today is the first day of the next 3 days where the top-level political officials from the countries, ministers from the countries meet. Frankly, today a lot of opening statements, but also a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiations. One, to get the United States to at least agree to allow discussions about the future of efforts to curb greenhouse gas emissions to continue under the Framework Convention. And one of the key concerns is whether or not the U.S. will allow that, because interestingly, a large number of developing countries now feel that while they can't take on binding targets and timetables the way the industrial countries have, they can do more, and it's under this Framework Convention that a lot of people see the best opportunity for engaging the developing countries.
Well, meantime, we know that there are immediate concerns because of the recent scientific reports about the effects of global warming. I'm thinking of the reports of the diminishing Arctic ice packs, of people being moved off of islands off the coast of Papua New Guinea. Is there a sense that participants there are saying, well, wait a minute, there's some action that needs to be taken right now?
Everybody recognizes that nobody's going to be able to flip the switch on carbon dioxide emissions today, but many of the tools that allow people to meet their targets are financial tools, and in order to keep the financial markets interested in this process over the long term that will then help people meet their emissions reduction goals, you've got to do something beyond 2012. So ironically, one of the big achievements of this, if it happens, of this meeting will be essentially an agreement to continue talking, but with some sort of firm deadlines for deciding how to continue negotiation.
Well, Peter Spatz, one last question. What is your sense of the attendees at the conference? I mean, these were, a few years ago, the chicken littles, you know, of the world, and now there's increasing evidence that they are right about global warming. Is there optimism about Kyoto, about the ability of these countries to take steps against global warming?
I think there is resolve to do it. Perhaps one of the most telling anecdotes I can think of, 5 years ago, when I was covering these talks in Europe, the only groups who were coming up to talk about the effects of global warming on themselves individually were people from developing countries. This year, we had a delegation of business people, environmentalists, government officials, local government officials from the southeastern United States giving a presentation that would have been coming out of Honduras 5 years ago. It's real, it's here, it's hitting us. This, of course, after the intense hurricane season we've had.
Peter Spatz, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, covering the United Nations Conference on Climate Change taking place in Montreal. Peter, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Actress Mary Louise Parker has had a career filled with rich characters. She plays the gentle Ruth who leaves her abusive husband to find happiness with Mary Stuart Masterson's Iggy in Fried Green Tomatoes. Oh, my goodness. We were so excited about bringing this story to you. Apparently, we've lost our tape, including a clip from Fried Green Tomatoes we wanted to bring with you. So we're just going to listen to some music for a second and see if we can find her. Mary Louise Parker, where are you? Alrighty then, we just had a technical problem here on Here and Now. We want to rejoin our conversation with Mary Louise Parker.
That's what you are, a bee charmer.
In the Showtime series Weeds, Parker plays a suburban homemaker trying to rationalize the fact that she also sells marijuana.
Nancy, you just have to make it look like you're running a bakery to legitimize your dealing.
You just called me a dealer.
You are a dealer.
We're in my house. I'm not a dealer. I'm a mother who happens to distribute illegal product through a sham bakery set up by my ethically questionable CPA and his crooked lawyer friend.
But Parker's greatest successes have been on Broadway. She's originated roles in both David Auburn's Proof and Craig Lucas's Prelude to a Kiss, only to see those parts go to Gwyneth Paltrow and Meg Ryan when film versions were made. Recently, Mary Louise Parker was at Boston University to open a retrospective of her career called Mary Louise Parker, A Profile in Acting. She also had a conversation with theater guru Robert Brustein. Beforehand, we sat down to talk with only one ground rule. No questions about her former boyfriend, actor Billy Crudup. No problem. With a career like hers, there's plenty to talk about. In fact, we began by asking, isn't 41 too young to have a retrospective?
Yeah, I hope so. My manager said, does this mean they want you to stop now? I don't know. It's really immensely flattering.
As you considered what you would give to the exhibition, you'd have to go back over your career. And I wonder, what was that like?
Well, truthfully, so much of my stuff my parents have. So I was just kind of grabbing boxes and going through things. And it was interesting, the things that moved me and the things that I didn't really care about. And
what moved you?
There was one piece actually from New York Magazine. They just kind of referred to me as this theater actress and just talked about how kind of rare that was, that I was somebody who, for whom theater wasn't slumming. And I just loved that they said that, and that just made me really happy. That and reading, you know, opening night cards. And then there were, you know, pictures of, from certain shows and plays that didn't work or that I was so worked up about. And now looking back thinking, you know, they didn't work, but we tried. And
the pain is somewhat abated. That's kind of nice.
Uh-huh. And it does seem part of a, I hate the word journey, but it does seem part of a path.
And then there's the studded dog collar that you wore as a Cockney dominatrix.
There are many dog collars. I don't know if they have all of them. Maybe they only have a couple. I've played a couple of dominatrixes.
Are you pleased with what you see as you look back? We want to look ahead with you, but are you pleased with what you see as you look back?
You know, I just, Lillian Gish said once, I think it was Lillian Gish that said she never felt in style, so she never had to worry about going out of style, and I kind of feel that way. You know, I just always felt like I just wanted to work, and I wanted to do theater, and I just want to go and punch a clock, kind of. People do attach a certain glamour to it, and there is a kind of glamour to it, but I feel like I've been able to make it a job.
And a job well done in the view of many critics. You won a Tony for your stage role in Proof, other awards as well. But I'm wondering, and even though it touched you to be seen as a real theater actress, others have called you an actor's actor, but is it also hard when you create a role on stage and then you see someone else take it to the big screen?
When it's happened to me initially, yeah. Both times when it happened to me, it happened really fresh off of doing the part or when I was still doing the part or, you know, and when you've been playing a part for that long and when you've created a part, which I did with both of those plays, they're
Proof and Prelude to a Kiss.
You feel very close to, I did both of those plays for a really, really long time. And I carried both of them from, you know, from readings practically and, you know, or from off Broadway or from regional theater. And you have a certain, you know, just kind of territorial feel, you know, towards them. And I don't know, I feel like, I don't know, I did it first, so eh.
But, and you also have a certain something that you telegraph, which is like, that what we spoke of, that you're a serious actress. And I'm wondering if some filmmakers like, no, we want the one who wants to go on the red carpet, who's interested in getting her face on the cover of People because that's good for our movie. Do you think that, I'm just wondering if you think that's a part of it?
I don't know. I mean, I think in the end people want to sell tickets and, personally, I would rather, if I had a choice between doing for Proof, the movie of Proof or the play of Proof, I would hands down rather have done, you know, a year and a half on Broadway of Proof than have, you know, 6 Oscars for the movie, hands down.
And that's what people love about you. Do you know that you telegraph whether you're doing a television show like Weeds or an appearance on the West Wing, that there's something about you that isn't for sale?
Oh, that's such a nice thing to say. I don't, wow. It's one of my favorite things anyone's ever said.
Oh, I'm right up there with the New Yorker article.
I don't know. Craig Lucas says that he feels like, in some ways I make the audience come to me and I want to go to the audience, that I don't want to, you know, I want to give the audience the benefit of the doubt. And I think that's true. I really don't want to assume that the audience is stupid. You know, I don't feel that you have to tell, you know, your audience everything. Not that you want to be completely opaque, but I feel like, you know, so many actors are just, they just tell you everything they're feeling. And it just is, I don't think people do that, you know. Somebody said to me recently, people are like icebergs, and I do believe that to be true. People don't tell you what they're feeling, you know. People, it's to me, it's about looking under rocks. That's what it is for me about discovering characters. It's all about what they're not saying, what people aren't saying, and what they aren't telling you. And I don't want to come out there and tell you what the character's feeling and saying, because I don't think people do that. You know, I'm not telling you what I'm feeling today necessarily, or what I came in the room here with. You know, you don't really know what I came in the room with. You know, and I don't really know what you're sitting here with. That's not reality.
That's actress Mary Louise Parker. For more on her career retrospective, which is on exhibit at Boston University, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Special thanks today to Showtime Networks. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.